It's easy to kill Hitler, said Professor Wells. The class tittered. 120 students smiling at the start of the lecture. A bit of a cheap shot, he knew, but it broke the ice well enough. A single hand went up. The professor saw it and, with an indulgent nod of his head, he waited for the owner to ask their question. It's not important, though, is it? The voice belonged to a young man with hazelnut brown skin and long black hair. The room laughed again, but this time it felt icy, as if they were anticipating a swift and delicious put-down. Wells stared at the questioner, and the glee left his face to be replaced by something deeper. An insightful question, he said. It is not important, at least not like the movies tell us. Can anyone tell us why? Not you, of course, he said to the young man, who looked disappointed. The people on either side of him nervously glanced his way while watching the rest of the room. Half a dozen hands went up and Wells pointed at someone sat three rows from the front. Another young man, dressed in a clean white shirt which marked him out from nearly everyone else in the room. Even Wells, who was wearing slacks and a heavy metal t-shirt from a recent European tour. Well, it creates plenty of new branching histories, but they still contain the Nazi Party. In most of them, the Second World War still occurs, and in those where it doesn't, the consequences are often even worse. Killing people doesn't change history enough for it to make a difference. Wells pointed a finger at the speaker. Exactly. Changing one thing is easy, but despite people thinking a butterfly flapping its wings over there and causing you all to get a 4.0 grade average over here, it's much harder to understand what creating a timeline actually achieves until after it's been done. And that's why we teach it to as many who will listen and allow only a very few to actually go and do it. Wells clapped his hands, ready to move on. Now, who managed to diagonalise the n-dimensional tensors you were sent as preparation for this course? Killing Hitler is Easy by Stuart Hodgson. Wells was reading his mail when the knock came on the door. The questioning young man from the lecture was stood on the other side, looking nervous, like he'd broken a window playing soccer. Come in, said Wells, and invited the young man to sit down on the other side of the desk. The room was square, with two big windows meeting in the western corner, beyond which lay a grassed quad. What can I do for you, Mr. Mahfouz? The student's name was Karim, but Wells liked to address everyone by their surnames, even his colleagues. I found something I wanted to show you, he said, refusing to meet Wells's gaze. Wells sighed. At least twice a year, a student would pitch up at his door with an inch-thick wad of papers, claiming they'd solved some great puzzle, or had a new theory which was superior to anything anyone had ever seen before. Nearly always they dropped out a few weeks later. Occasionally, security and even lawyers ended up involved. Training provided by HR suggested the best way to deal with it was to let the student in question explain themselves. Then, once they were gone, call for support. Make sure to get them help, but also make sure to change the locks. So, instead of screaming in despair, he asked Karim what it was that he wanted to talk about. Karim tucked his hair behind his ears, one at a time, and then, with a deep breath, started talking. No thick pad of paperwork, no laptop out onto the desk full of nonsense calculations. Just 100 words per minute.
We were drunk on Freshers' Week, see? Well, I say we, everyone. I mean, the whole floor of my dorm. And we got talking about the proliferation of branches in the timeline and talking about where the extra energy came from. You know, because if conservation of energy is real, then we can't be making new timelines. Because each one creates a whole new universe, and where does the energy come from for that?
Here we go, thought Wells.
Karim Mahfouz shook his head. "Well, that's not really important, though," he said. We talked about all sorts of shit, really." "What do you want to show me?" asked Wells, getting a little impatient. His words appeared to focus the young man, who jerked as if he'd been pinched.
Yes, I think someone's pruning the timelines."
Wells's fingers felt glued to the desk. "How did you reach this conclusion?" He wanted to say more, to stand up and shout, to call those who needed to know, but not with the boy in the room.
"You've been trying to grow timelines in which the dictators and oppressors didn't come to power," said Karim, repeating the mantra children were taught in their first year at school, the subject of more television shows than Wells could name.
"Yes," said Wells, nodding, when Karim slowed down to a halt.
"To stop the unintended genocide of peoples we didn't even know."
Wells waited, hoping there was more than a high school child's repetition of the basics.
"I kind of thought people were supposed to track the timelines after they were generated, to see what happened," said Karim, but he didn't wait for Wells to respond.
"We were joking around, see, trying to see if there was one where the Viadalid debate resulted in the encomienda being properly liberated, or if the flying machines invented in the 13th century had been prompted into being something more than intellectual curiosities."
He frowned.
"I wanted to see some of the timelines where the Library of Nalanda or the House of Wisdom survived, and how the preservation changed their timelines. But when I went looking under the index, I couldn't find them. It was as if they'd never been created."
Wells shifted uncomfortably in his seat. He'd seen the Nalanda timeline, and how the persistence of the Buddhist library in India had prepared the entire continent to better resist the European colonization so often found elsewhere. No one was supposed to know that it was gone across all the timelines where they were active.
"How, if you don't mind me asking, did you find out?"
Mahfouz laughed.
"You know, just about anyone with a VPN and some bots can get access to the archives, right?"
Wells didn't say anything, couldn't say anything, for fear of choking.
"Don't you want me to show you?" Mahfouz asked.
Wells stood up, feeling like a puppet, hands and feet jerking uncertainly.
"Come with me?"
he asked, the boy's news rendering him somehow in charge of them both. Karim nodded meekly and gathered himself up. Wells noticed he was chunky, sweaty, still nervous, yet with a clear, earnest face. He seemed older than his peers. Was he a mature student?
I'm sorry, Karim said.
Ha! Wells laughed, the sound of it making Karim jump back as if afraid of being punched. He marched them up to the top level of the research block, to the head of department's office. He knocked, but didn't wait before going in. A woman with rich cocoa skin and deep green eyes, in a bright red and blue playsuit, waved at him and continued to talk on a video call. Wells sat down, then noticed Karim stood in the doorway, clutching at his elbows. He beckoned him in, indicating he should find a chair. "It's almost cute," he thought, realizing he couldn't remember ever feeling that way. Willis finished up her call and, with a small frown, said,
"What can I do for the two of you?"
Wells languidly encompassed Karim with a flick of his wrist.
"The eagle-eyed Mahfouz here has spotted something out in the wild."
Willis turned to Karim, who shrank back from her gaze before speaking. He explained what he'd said to Wells, who watched silently while he talked. The young man was uncommonly certain, even if he clearly struggled with the anxiety of talking to two of his lecturers. Wells couldn't remember how he'd come to the department, or what his undergraduate had been in, but the selection process was rigorous. They picked agents from this intake. It might only be one or two a year at most, but no one was accepted onto the master's programme if they weren't seen as potential candidates. As Karim spoke, Willis slowly sat stiffer, her fingers flat against the desk.
Henry? She asked, when Kareem had finished speaking.
We came straight here, Miss Willis, said Wells.
What do you know about the work that we do here? She asked Kareem. His eyes bugged out, and Wells wanted to snap his fingers and tell the boy to get a grip. There was no point bringing news like this if he wasn't then capable of taking it further.
What is it with young people who think they could say one truth and change the world?
Willis pursed her lips thinner and thinner the longer Kareem failed to respond.
I think the point here is how he found out, said Wells into the awkward silence.
Shona Willis dragged her gaze across to him, and Wells remembered why it could be so hard to answer her.
Well, I was researching in the archives, said Kareem.
He frowned.
To be fair, it was Dolly who wrote the bots that accessed the system for us.
He smiled, as if giving her credit was to be lauded. Wells watched Shona's face sour, like she'd sucked on a grapefruit. He held up a hand to forestall the typhoon he could see building in her face.
It's why we're here, Miss Willis.
He didn't need to talk about security reviews, about the ramifications of what Kareem had brought to them. Many, many hours would be spent on that in the following days and weeks. He stood up to leave, but Kareem didn't follow.
Come on, he said. We've done what we needed to today.
You'll need to be back here in a couple of hours, said Shona to Kareem. We're going to want to interview you. Please bring a list of your fellow pupils who have seen the archives and those who worked on accessing the system.
Kareem paled. Don't panic, said Wells,
staring hard at Willis, hoping she'd shut the hell up now.
We need to know exactly what you did so we can tighten up security.
Kareem didn't look hugely comforted, and Wells clenched his fist, unable and unwilling to express his frustration in front of his superior.
What about the edited timelines? He asked them.
Wells felt his shoulders droop. He saw Willis's strength fade too. He met her gaze and nodded. She snorted air like she'd been punched. The decision was made. What I tell you now doesn't leave this room. From this point, you're under the Official Secrets Act, and effectively an agent of the government. She stared at Kareem. Wells didn't dare look. It wasn't how things were done. What were they going to do with Kareem's accomplices? He ground his teeth. They couldn't exclude them, nor could they bring them all inside the tent. His class alone was more than 100 students. His eyes watered at the idea of how far access to the archives had spread among the student base. We're not the only ones, Kareem. Others are out there, creating branches, pruning others. We're at war. Kareem nodded, but then said, I don't understand. He knows how branching works, right? Please tell me he has the basics, she asked Wells. But Kareem spoke up to confirm he understood those well enough. Fine then. She slammed the desk with a closed fist. We weren't the first. She said nothing more for a moment, letting the implications sink in.
Who was?
Asked Kareem.
We don't know, said Shona. We think one of the earliest branches, the trunk, if you will, goes back to a conflicted and confused world about a century ago. They destroyed themselves. The entire planet's an irradiated horror show, so there's precious little we can do to prove our speculation. But the branches we know of all seem to lead there.
How many others are there? He asked,
and Wells was impressed with the question.
Active and mapped?
Nearly 80. That's not counting the other agencies here in our timeline, who act according to their own agendas.
Yes, I know, she said, holding up a hand. There are international accords on permitted activities. Do you think you're the only one happy to break the rules? They made us, Karim said, shaking his head and looking at the floor. Wells remembered how he'd felt 2 decades before upon receiving the same news. He'd been nonplussed when one of the tutors invited him and 2 others from his year to a small off-timetable meeting and told them about the big things they could achieve. He'd rapidly felt his pride swell. He could feel the heat in his chest at being chosen, even now. Then had come the vertigo of discovering that they weren't original. That out there, all the other versions of himself were just as derivative as he was. He'd suppressed the nausea, and eventually found a way to equalise the confusion. The other two had spun out, one leaving and disappearing entirely, the other ending up as a chemist. The 3 of them never spoke again. There are no originals, he said to Karim. As Miss Willis says, they're all dead. We're what's left. We are the stewards of creation, said Shona firmly, and Wells was glad she'd finally brought out her sales pitch. There are worlds where the majority populations oppress those without power, structure their societies to make it permanent. There are worlds where Hitler died and even worse people came to power. You know all this. Well, some of us have experienced it, Karim. Now you will, too. What we have here is fragile and precious beyond value. We fight on our own borders, daily, as well as pruning those timelines who might try to harm us. She paused, as if unhappy with what she was admitting. Wells decided to step in. You'll have read 100 stories about people creating timelines in which the consequences of their actions were untold chaos and suffering. Well, nothing I'm saying here should leave you with the impression that we're darting around the polyline day in and day out. Last year, there were no sanctioned operations at all. The year before that, 2. We spend our time trying to understand, to prepare the right seeds, the right stories to create the change we want. Karim nodded, as if he finally understood. Wells waited for the question.
Every moment that passes, all worlds diverge and grow further apart, said Karim, holding his fingers up as if to count on them. The longer we are from the trunk, the less effective we can be in pruning existing worlds, and the more likely we are to interfere in worlds who can interfere back, he said.
We've discovered no way of hiding from those with the same technology as us, said Shona, nodding. We hope the possibility of mutually assured destruction keeps all but the most dangerous from acting.
We've no way of communicating, except through seeding ideas, and in doing so, creating new timelines.
Because the meeting of 2 timelines of any kind only creates further timelines, said Wells.
The future's determined then, Karim said.
The future of every timeline's determined, from the first to the last singularity, said Shona.
And each change creates a new timeline, including going forwards in time, because no matter where we go, it's still someone else's history.
Are we winning? He asked. Shona sighed, and Wells felt the weight of it all pressed down on him. His throat closed up and he couldn't speak.
We are still here, Shona said eventually. Then she was gone.
Wells looked at the empty space and gasped before he felt his own body turn insubstantial.
Karim, he managed.
But the young man was staring at him with the oddest expression. He looked disappointed. Karim cursed as Wells vanished. He pulled a small screen from his pocket and unfolded it until it was about the size of his hand. Images appeared in 3 dimensions over the top, and he flicked through them with his free hand, hissing as he went. The air grew tight, his skin cold, like a winter storm had blown through the office. He closed the door behind him, pulled up the hood on his hoodie, and scuttled from the building, hands in pockets.
pick up,
he muttered as he went. The call was answered as he got out of the complex, onto the grass lawns Shona Willis's office had overlooked.
Kareem, what's happened?
We were too late. They inserted ideas further back. Changed everything here.
Define everything,
said the voice. Higher pitched than his, better groomed.
Delilah, I love you, but sometimes they evaporated before my eyes. Classic replacement theory. Building still here, but I can't tell if all the people of colour have gone, or if we're slaves or menials or what. How quickly before you can pull me out?
What did those substitutes look like?
Asked Delilah, sounding calm in a way that he absolutely did not feel. He paused.
They hadn't arrived before I left.
A woman in a white coat walked across the courtyard and their eyes met momentarily. She did a double take and hurried on, as if he'd threatened to attack her. Seeing no one else, Kareem hurried out of the courtyard in the opposite direction. He'd passed an old abandoned temple on the way in. Perhaps he could hide there until they retrieved him.
We need a counteraction, he said. We can't just walk away.
I thought you wanted retrieving,
she replied.
Come on, he cried. You're seriously telling me we're going to give up another world to the fascists?
There was a bitter sigh on the other end of the line.
No, of course not. It's not good though, Kareem. They hit this timeline's London in the early 19th century, persuaded several key folk not to go into politics, showed others how slavery could be reduced and still be economically viable by working with the Industrial Revolution and not against it. It's fucking brilliant work.
Kareem's heart burned at being outplayed, at so many people being turned against him so easily. He reached the road on which the temple stood and stopped.
Let me guess, they revived nationalist Odinism, he said, staring up at the building.
Give me a moment,
said Delilah.
Yes, how did you know?
The previously derelict temple was now covered in marble and gold, its shattered windows made whole and glinting in the sunshine as people bustled around the main entrance. Kareem ducked back, decided to walk away. As he did so, two white men in sharp grey paramilitary uniforms went rushing down the street towards the block he'd fled. Trying to look like he belonged, Kareem kept on walking, a cold fear gripping his spine in the back of his head as he went.
How did we get it so wrong? He asked.
They were supposed to attack Shard 359W,
said Delilah in his ear.
What are they doing here?
The question wasn't really for her, and she didn't answer. Delilah gave him directions which took him away from the university and onto the road leading to the nearby town. The fields were yellow with rapeseed, and despite the danger, Kareem slowed to take in the beauty. He reached the very edge of town as two cars ripped past. They both had four people in them, and as he watched, they slowed, stopped, and started to execute three-point turns.
Time's running out, he said.
Kareem clambered over the hedge and into the rapeseed field and ran. The cars screeched to a halt and he heard car doors slamming.
How much longer?
2 minutes,
said Delilah.
Shit!
He reckoned he had 100 metres on them, maybe less. His pursuers were shouting at him, demanding he stop. He had no intention of being any nearer to them than he was right then. Ideally, he'd be several timelines away. The field was an odd shape, and he was forced to climb over another fence, this one barely worthy of the name, except it slowed him down and allowed them to catch up that little bit. Pulse pounding in his throat, lungs burning, Kareem ran across the furrows, trampling whatever short crops were growing underfoot. The sound of his clothes, his feet on soil, and the encroaching noise of the murderer bastards closing the distance hissed in his ears. The world flashed, purple, pink, blue, and he fell into nothing. Feet on a steel floor, scuffed by hundreds of shoes before him. Head spinning. Vomit directed into the nearest bucket, kindly provided for everyone who came home this way. Kareem fell to his knees, spit hanging from his lips.
"It was too fucking close," he rasped.
"Grow up,"
said a voice. Kareem flipped a finger in the general direction of those watching him. They were behind extremely thick glass, waiting until they were sure he wasn't compromised or about to expire.
"I'm fine, by the way,"
he said, before pushing the bucket away with a slosh of sick over the side. The map room was a manic flurry of bad colour. Kareem stormed in, but slowed to a stop as he saw the network unravelling before his eyes. He'd assumed he'd been caught by bad calculations, that the coordination team had made an error. Delilah came and waited for him to absorb what was really going on.
"They're everywhere,"
he said eventually, trying to hold back tears. She took his hand as they stood together. She didn't reply for a moment, then pointed a finger at a conjunction of branches right down towards the original world. "They came from there."
"How are the borders?"
"We're safe, for now. None of our key ideas have been challenged."
"They're going around us,"
he said emptily. Delilah felt silent again.
"We're losing?"
More than half the branches were red, the colour for if they'd fallen to ideas considered anathema to a fair and just society. In among the sound and frantic motion of hundreds of people working to understand how they'd been outplayed, Kareem felt an urge to just fall down and give up. "They want to see you," said Delilah. Kareem jerked into motion, touching his fingers to her arm in farewell. The board were in session, but the guards waved him through the large double doors. The board table had 36 seats. Every one of them was occupied, and then all the space around them, out to the walls, filled with people standing. No one turned to see as he entered, but when he was finally noticed, they called him forward. Thurrock held up an arm.
"You made it back," she said. "Many did not."
He wanted to ask how it had happened. He wanted to know what they were going to do. He wanted to know when they were sending him back further into the past, and with what ideas he'd be armed this time. Kareem wanted to know how soon he'd be fighting again.
"You're here because we've lost," said Thurrock.
The room erupted in panic, anger, disbelief. People around Kareem shouted and screamed. Someone grabbed him from the side and held on like they'd drown if he forced them to let go. His chest threatened to squeeze him to death. Breathing took all his willpower. Other members of the board remained quiet. Kareem watched people wipe tears from their eyes. His own body shut down, the sense of panic washing over him until he felt he'd drowned already and was watching them from above, disembodied. The air tasted of abandoned ruin.
"You've been called here, not to save us. It's too late. We're hoping you'll do one last assignment."
The room wasn't listening. Kareem pushed himself free of the man holding on to him. He shoved the man in front, pulled at a woman to his right. Slowly, silence rippled out from them in a wave. The room quieted down. He caught Thurrock's eyes, and liquid understanding passed between them.
"You don't have to stay here. We'll find safe branches for you, whatever happens. But what we're talking about now is survival. We're talking time of the long now eventualities. If you volunteer, there should be no expectation of coming back or of going with those you love. We'll provide you with one of our best estimates for deploying weaponized ideas, but you'll be on your own. We know we're home."
"They'll find us,"
said someone fearfully. Thurrock shook her head.
"They are branches created for just this possibility.
hidden in the folds, barely different to where we are today and unmapped. Our best guess is that they won't find them for decades.
They might find them earlier,
called out a thin rake of a man on the other side of the table to Kareem. He didn't look frightened or angry, just tired.
There's always risk, said Kareem, before anyone else could speak. This is our chance. I was there today when they came for us. They were ready. They'd been planning. Their stories are better than ours, at every stage.
The mood darkened again, but he wasn't having it.
You know this. You've all seen it. We're right. We're just. What we want is good. But they twist and turn people against themselves again and again. We got it wrong. The truth hasn't been enough. The evidence of how everyone prospers in just societies is just too easily ignored. So we go. We regroup and grow strong timelines, and we come back to win.
He dared anyone to speak up, raising his voice to command the room, the words like iron bars in his mind.
We take what we can and we start again. This war isn't lost. Creation can still reflect our values, but only if we find new stories, new ways of showing people how the world could be.
He saw Thurrock nod, and then he stumbled from the room in search of Delilah. The map room was the scarlet of arterial bleeds by the time Kareem left. The enemy had found their borders and were slowly breaking through with memetic seed bombs scattered across continents and centuries. Nearly all of them were being rooted out, but 1 in 100 got through, and the changes were being mapped as best as they could while the evacuations continued. Kareem marvelled at the skill with which their world was being undone, how entire civilizations were being rewritten to prefer the prosperity of the few, or the scapegoating of the weak, with nothing more than a few ideas placed into the right moments, the right hands. They were lined up in the departure zone of the map room. There wasn't time to send people out to the normal centres they used for gatewaying to other timelines. There wasn't time to bring more people home. Kareem watched the room with a sense of heaviness, his heart sunken into his stomach. He wanted to reach out and save them all, to find a way to win. People hugged one another, kissed, held hands. Tears were everywhere, and the very light diminished, as if it too was saying farewell. He'd lost Delilah in the rush, after every single hand went up. The facility was falling apart as the first few dozen were sent to their sanctuary timelines. It might be for the best they'd not seen one another, because how could he say goodbye forever? He remained speechless, as those with families chose to leave them behind for the slenderest chance to make a difference. He gulped at the idea of those left behind being erased, of their lives ceasing, except in the memories of those who fled to other timelines. A young man approached with a rucksack, handing it off to Kareem, who promptly dropped it. Inside were books, thumb drives, writing equipment.
"Where are you sending me?"
he asked.
"The House of Wisdom," said the young man.
Kareem laughed and tried not to cry as well. He'd been to it 7 times now, across various timelines. Always glorious, always tragically lost to the Mongols, but always with a legacy that changed the world.
"Seems a bit obvious," he said.
"You're going to found it,"
said the young man, and then hurried on. The thing about Baghdad was no one got the colours right. Underneath, the city was a kind of
yellowy-red patchwork of stone, but you could see that only where buildings were being erected. Anything standing long enough for people to move in was a riot of blues, whites, yellows, reds and greens. The people of the city loved colour, loved geometry, and loved putting the two together for human eyes to see. Karim was outside the main southern artery on the edge of the Badaraya district. The Isa Canal flowed past him on the left. He guessed the Dogs Canal was a bit further north. He had a decent walk to get to the Round City, assuming it had been built already. They'd taken all his gear, not even a picture of Delilah, but it would help keep him hidden from the enemy. There was no going home. Karim sat on the banks of the canal for a while, not really seeing the world at all. "Who am I now?" he wondered, staring at the sky as the sun sank behind him. The smell of the city assaulted his nose, the water before him dirty and rank as barges navigated along it piled high with almonds, dates, olives, fabric, livestock and people. He decided to put the possibility of the enemy finding him, of rendering this world hostile to people of colour, from his mind. "I have a chance to build resilience here," he thought. "I can tell new stories." He thought about the mathematics in his bags, of the chemistry and biology he could reveal, and believed that all of it, while important, needed to come only so he could find better stories to tell the world about the glory of acceptance and equality. Karim dusted his trousers with the palms of his hands and was approached by a young man, no more than 13. "What are you looking for?" he was asked in the local language. He caught himself before asking for the library.
"I'm an emissary, here to speak with Abu Jafar Abdallah ibn Muhammad al-Mansur."
The boy's face, which had been cautiously looking at Karim's combat trousers and waterproof jacket, lit up, and he grabbed him by the hand.
"This way. Come, I'll take you."
Karim allowed himself to be pulled along, and with one last look at the spot where he'd arrived, set out to change the world all over again. Killing Hitler is Easy was written by Stuart Hotston and performed by Dion Winton Pollock. It has never been published before, so this is a Fine-Toothed Comb exclusive. Links to the author, his books and other writings can be found in the show notes, along with attributions for the music and sound effects used. Killing Hitler is Easy was a Fine-Toothed Comb production.